You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On November 30th, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein requested a recount of votes in Michigan. That request was the beginning of a frantic week of legal and court battles and county clerks rallying staff and resources to undertake the recount. But now the statewide recount appears to be over after federal judges ruling late last night. It appears to have effectively ended the process. Here with us now is Jill Stein, the Green Party's presidential candidate. Dr. Stein, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Cindy.
Federal Judge Mark Goldsmith lifted that restraining order that had triggered the recount this past Monday. The Board of State Canvassers canceled its meeting earlier today. From what we see, it appears the recount effort in Michigan has ended. But what options do you have left?
Well, we have filed an appeal with the state Supreme Court asking that the citizens of the state of Michigan be entitled to verify their vote and to know that this is an election that we can have confidence in and that it was fair, accurate, and just.
Would you, if you didn't get a favorable ruling from the state Supreme Court, would you go to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals?
We understand that there is not a legal basis for going further in the Sixth District Federal Court.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if the state Supreme Court keeps the door open, you would continue to press. If the state Supreme Court closes the door, does that end it from where you sit?
Well, it ends the recount. However, it does not end the fight for elections that we can trust. And in many ways, the efforts, the extraordinary efforts on the part of the cronies of Donald Trump, his PACs, the Republican Party, the Attorney General and so on, there was an all-out mobilization here to block the right of citizens to have a vote that we can have confidence in. We are entitled to a recount process, and that process was obstructed at every turn, and I think it leaves people feeling very disturbed. We asked the question, can we verify the vote? And basically what we've been told is that this vote cannot be verified. And, in the course of this recount, very important information was brought to light. For example, that 87 optical scanners failed in Detroit, making the point that there is a de facto Jim Crow type election system going on here where people of color, are at a vastly increased risk of having their vote miscounted, discounted, or tossed into the trash heap. In fact, according to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, the odds that your vote will not be counted if you are in an African-American community is increased by about 900% over a, Caucasian community. That's not fair, and that is what came to light just by discovering the massive failure of the optical scanners. Also, the fact that many counties many precincts are labeled unrecountable. And this is largely, again, in areas of color, which says that people of color are not entitled to the same kind of verification, transparency, and assurances that other Americans are entitled to. So in the process of doing the recount, we discovered that there is a grave and serious need here to do that recount and to scrutinize this vote and to ensure, among other things, that there hasn't been really substantial failure.
There certainly, through the limited recount that was done, it certainly raised questions for many about Michigan's election law, that for example, if a number's transposed or if numbers don't match up, it doesn't account for human error. It just says you can't recount that precinct. But in all of that, did you discover anything that supported concerns about hacking and about tampering?
The thing about hacking and tampering is that it is invisible unless you actually count the ballots and examine them. And it is also invisible in the electronic machines unless you examine them with a forensic study of exactly how they've been programmed. So, there is no evidence, but the absence of proof is not the proof of absence. if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You actually need to examine the ballots and the internal programming of the machines in order to know. So we will not know. But in my view, there is plenty of reason right now. We don't need to go looking for hackers, although we might very well find that. But right now, there's reason enough to be very concerned about the outcome of this election and the credibility, accuracy, and fairness of the vote.
Speaking of disenfranchisement, Dr. Stein, voter fraud and stricter voting laws have been used by the GOP for years to make voting more difficult, and something critics argue disproportionately disenfranchise poor and minority and elderly voters. And so I'm wondering, are you concerned that this effort and your concerns and talk of potential fraud, could that actually support the GOP and feed into this?
You know, the GOP actually does not have evidence of what they see is, you know, people voting, people who are undocumented, for example, voting. There's absolutely no evidence of that, and it's been examined many times. On the other hand, there is abundant evidence that the exact opposite is taking place. That is, that millions of people actually are being stripped off of the voter rolls. So we know there's a problem here, and what we're saying is that this is not a problem that we fix by denying it or by sweeping it under the rug. The more we bring it out into the light of day, the more I think the concerns we have articulated are going to be underscored, validated, proven that there is an injustice going on here. My hope coming out of this is that we build bridges between the community fighting voter suppression and the community fighting for election integrity, because there's enormous overlap.
Dr. Stein, if the state Supreme Court denies your appeal, what will you be doing with the money that was donated for the recount?
So the money donated for the recount is for the three states involved in the recount. And we have battles that are fully engaged in the other states as well. If there is money left over, which currently it does not look like there will be, we are fully, those dollars are fully accounted for right now, and that can all be seen in a completely transparent fashion on our donation page. If it turns out, lo and behold, that there is money left over, which would be great, so if there is money left over, that money will either be returned to donors, or that money will be spent on ongoing nonprofit activities to continue the fight for election integrity and a voting system we can trust.
One final question. How would you characterize the Democrats' support of this overall recount effort in Michigan?
Extremely lukewarm and missing in action. As far as I'm aware, the only action that the Democrats took, that Hillary Clinton took, actually, and which is different from Democrats, because there are, in fact, many progressive Democrats that are participating as volunteers and observers and donors and all that. There are people across the political spectrum that have concerns about, you know, as Donald Trump says, this rigged election. So that part of it is nonpartisan. In terms of, in other states as well, the Democratic Party, or I should say Hillary Clinton's campaign, filed, I think, testimony in one state, I believe in Wisconsin, and I believe that's the only action I have heard of. And their support was expressed on a blog by a lawyer, you know, certainly nothing that's been particularly hard-hitting. If Hillary Clinton had stood up here for voting integrity, for assuring voters that we could have confidence, they could have blown through many of the hurdles that have been put up in the way of a recount campaign filed by a candidate who did not have a personal stake in the outcome. And at the end, that's why we were stopped in Michigan. The court said, you don't personally have a stake, you're not going to personally benefit, everything stops here. In my view, that, you know, the fact that I didn't have a personal stake made this all the more credible and believable, because I don't have a conflict of interest here. But unfortunately, that's the way the law read. Had Hillary Clinton been more engaged, we could have gone much farther. Same thing happened, you know, in John Kerry's election in 2004. I think he went snowboarding. And it was the Green Party that raised the challenge in Ohio, where there were all kinds of red flags. And, in fact, a couple of election officials, in fact, did jail time for crimes committed in the course of that election or the recount. So these are legitimate issues. What has come out of these recounts before is not a change in the election result, but actually the creation of a movement for voting integrity and for ensuring that we have an accurate, secure, and just vote. The state of New Mexico, in fact, tried to do a recount in 2004. They were stopped in court as well. And they went forward then and went from, basically they had litigation and then legislation. So they were able to fix their voting system. They got rid of the fallible, error-prone electronic voting machines. They instituted automatic audits and automatic recounts. So they have really created a system that voters can have quite a bit of confidence in. That's the standard we all need to come up to.
Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein, thank you so much for being with us.
Great talking with you, Cindy.
After the break, one woman's story of recovery from opioid addiction that began with the very first pill.
Honestly, it was all over with from there. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what I was doing or what I was getting myself into. I thought I was just having fun.
Then, instead of controlling technology, what happens when technology begins to control you? What does that mean for society as a whole? Author Alexander Weinstein explores this in his new book, Children of the New World. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was Theodore Roosevelt who declared the presidency as a bully pulpit, and our incoming 45th president clearly agrees. Donald Trump doesn't even take the oath of office for 49 days, but he's already used his favorite tool, Twitter, to send some crystal clear messages to businesses and unions. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here to talk about Exhibit A, Carrier Corporation. Daniel, what should CEOs learn in this whole episode of Mr. Trump taking a big bow for saving jobs at Carrier Manufacturing Plant in Indiana?
I think the first thing is get on the right side of some of these issues. Corporate America, for the longest time, particularly companies that have been involved in any way, shape, or form outside the United States, have pretty much been making decisions that allow capital, their capital, to flow across international boundaries. And I think Donald Trump has made it very clear first, before the election, and with Ford Motor Company moving jobs to Mexico, moving production to Mexico, and now Carrier Corporation. And now, just more this week, he's gone after Boeing for costs associated with building a new Air Force One. I saw a report in another media outlet that talked about Trump turning to one of his aides and saying, you know, give me a list of all the companies that we can find that are planning to move jobs outside the United States, and maybe I'll just give them a call. Mm. I mean, he is clearly putting people on, the CEOs, on notice. And you know what? The voting public, at least based on some polls, love it. They don't care about the implications. They are not at all interested. They just want to see the fruits of this hectoring come to be, and that is, can you create more jobs in the United States?
Break it down for us. We certainly get the sense of what the stick is. What's the carrot?
Well, I think the carrot is, if you get on the right side of this, it will redound to your benefit. Clearly, the other thing is that this administration is signaling a very aggressive pro-growth strategy in terms of taxes, cutting regulation. You know, some of the appointments, like the head of the EPA, have got the environmental crowd all a Twitter, no pun intended, because they're very concerned about what kind of viewpoint some of these people are going to be bringing into the cabinet. But I think business in general looks at this and says, hey, you know what? At the end of the day, money is fungible. Money is money is money. And if we can save on taxes and on fewer regulations, maybe we can keep those jobs here in the United States. And I think that's what a CEO president is appealing to, is basically saying, look, you and I both know how this game is played. And this is a way that we can do it.
Well, it's interesting. You make your point in today's column, and it's a good one, that presidents imposing their will and their vision on business. Mm-hmm. Nothing new. Barack Obama and his auto task force.
Right.
Labor, President Reagan and the Air Traffic Controllers Union. But they were in the White House. They'd been the president. Donald Trump hasn't put his hand on that Bible and taken the oath of office. So why should he be doing this now?
Because he can. Not to be too oversimplified, but I think, I mean, he uses those clubs very effectively. And I think a lot of people who doubted him on both sides of the political aisle have now seen him win this race and is now the president-elect. And I think their view is this is the guy we're going to have to deal with. Now, we got to figure out how we're going to deal with him, or do we want to have an enemy in the White House for 4 or 8 years? I don't think so. I think a lot of these guys are saying, and women, no, I don't think we do. So let's figure out how we can work with him. And I think Ford is very instructive here. At the highest point that they were getting beaten up by Donald Trump, they were privately behind the scenes working their relationships in Washington, working their relationships inside of his transition team, clearly wanting to be able to communicate and tell them what they're doing, why they're doing it, and they're not the only ones. They see an opportunity here. They see an opportunity perhaps to, if not roll back, certainly soften some of the fuel, tough federal fuel economy regulations that really are driving a lot of cost and are forcing automakers to build cars that a lot of the public just is not buying. And that costs a lot of money, too.
What approach should CEOs think of taking for someone who, when he gets on Twitter, bends the truth? Case in point, his tweet of November 17th. I'll quote here Mr. Trump's tweet. I worked hard with Bill Ford to keep the Lincoln plant in Kentucky. I owed it to the great state of Kentucky for their confidence in me! Exclamation point. A, there is no Lincoln plant. And B, that wasn't going anywhere. So how do you work with that kind of...
Well, that's a very good question. But I would have to say, let's go back. If we go back to the bailouts of 08 and 09, and the way in which I couldn't tell you how many columns I wrote back then, and it, certainly in the 2012 cycle, about how politicians were mischaracterizing what happened in Detroit and what didn't happen in the bailout. My favorite is, of course, the New York Times headline over Mitt Romney's name, mm-hmm. Let Detroit Go Bankrupt, and how the Democrats beat him about the head and shoulders with that, how Jennifer Granholm beat him about the head and shoulders, and it was Barack Obama who took General Motors and Chrysler into bankruptcy. You know, I mean, that's a classic example. So I'm not making an excuse for Trump here, but what I'm suggesting is that it is very frequent that you'll see politicians that will bend the truth to make their point. Now, the final thing I would say is I think one way you deal with it is the facts. And Ford Motor Company has been pretty straightforward in rebutting some of this and saying, well, no, that's not exactly what happened. In the earlier case about the compact cars going to Mexico, they said, look, no jobs are going to be lost in the United States, which is a true statement. Now, critics will immediately come back and say, yeah, but if they kept that plant here in the United States, there would be more American jobs created. But I think one of the realities we're seeing in the auto industry is nobody, even at the top of the cycle, is building new plants in the United States. That's not going to happen.
Well, interesting times as we get ready for that inauguration day, 49 days hence. Detroit News Business columnist Daniel Howes, as always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan has a real fight on its hands, a fight to keep people out of the clutches of opioid and heroin addiction. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services offers some stunning numbers that show just how badly this fight is going. In 1999, there were 99 heroin or opioid overdose deaths. In 2014, that number climbed to over 1,000. That's 10 times as many deaths in just 15 years. As we continue our series, Minding Michigan, we welcome a woman who's a recovering opioid addict. These days, she works to keep others on the path to recovery. Christy Kopeck is a recovery coach with Victory Clinical Services in Saginaw, and she's a member of Peer 360, an organization of people in recovery. Christy, welcome.
Hi.
Tell us how old you were when you first started using.
I was about 16 years old when I first started using.
And what did you start with?
I had actually started smoking marijuana, and there was really no reason for it. I basically did it because the friends that I was hanging out with, and my boyfriend at the time was doing it. And to me, it seemed cool, and I wanted to fit in.
And what effect did that have on you?
Well, in the beginning, I liked the effects, to be honest with you. But as time went on, it affected my grades, my job, my life, the other friends that I had. It affected my whole life all the way around.
And then when did you start using opioids, and what did you use? How did that begin?
I was 17 when I first used opiates. I had actually taken a couple Vicodin that my boyfriend that I was with at the time had gotten. We actually were at a party, and, you know, he said it would be fun and it would make you feel relaxed. And it was like smoking marijuana, but it was more intense than that. So I took them, and honestly, it was all over with from there. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what I was doing or what I was getting myself into. I thought I was just having fun.
What was the feeling like of taking it? When you were saying it was all over at the time, are you trying to say, gee, it felt so good that, you know, this is terrific?
Yes, in a sense. It made me feel relaxed. I mean, I was in high school and stuff and, you know, had always struggled with having friends and I was shy. It took all of that away.
And as you say, it was all over even though you didn't know it at the time. What did you mean by that?
That in just taking that first pill, I didn't know it at the time, but I was instantly addicted after that. Mm. I liked it so much and I wanted to do it more and more often that I became addicted after that first pill.
And then how long were you using into the point where you realized, boy, I've got a problem? And did you ever use that word addict in thinking about yourself?
No, I didn't. Not in the beginning. No, not at all. It was probably almost a year after I took the first pill that I had realized that there might be something wrong. I didn't know. I mean, I took DARE in elementary school, but I didn't know what a drug addict was. I mean, I had my perception of them and the stigma that goes along with them and people that you see in the streets, but I didn't know that anybody could be a drug addict, and I didn't know the effects of being an addict and being sick when you didn't have it and all of that. So I knew nothing about that. When I started waking up in the morning feeling sick or tired when I didn't have it, that's when I realized that I think there's something wrong.
Now, but you never crossed over to using heroin, did you?
I did a couple times, but only when I couldn't get what I wanted. I actually used OxyContin, which people say is synthetic heroin, and that's what I used.
Ultimately, then, with your road to recovery, Christy, what worked for you? What got you to a point where you can say, I am a recovering addict?
I guess going through everything that I had gone through, meeting the people that I did, going to NA meetings, and then I guess basically being around the people that I had been around and hearing their stories and seeing what it was like for them to live life clean and sober. And I wanted that life. I wanted to wake up in the morning and not be sick and have to go chase drugs and call people and wait. And I didn't want to have to do that anymore. So I decided that it was time for me to get clean. I had also had two kids. And I wanted to be there for them as a parent. I had seen a lot of people who had their kids taken away who will never see their kids again. And I didn't want to put my kids through that. That's the point when I realized that I want to be in recovery. I need to be in recovery.
How many tries did it take?
It actually took me about seven tries. Seven. But only one time I went to an inpatient treatment center. Every other time I tried to do it by myself, alone, with nothing and no one to support me, which after I learned more about it, I realized that's not the way to go.
Which is why, for you working as a recovery coach, you realize that as you look at other people trying to get clean and not use.
Yes, definitely. You have to have a good support system and go to NA or even AA meetings. And it helps a lot if you have family that support you or even a friend or even just a recovery coach. Having one other person there that you can talk to when you need to helps a lot.
Christy, was there a program that clicked for you? Was it NA, Narcotics Anonymous, or what was it that really turned the key for you?
Honestly, I had gotten into a methadone program, and that was what clicked for me. That was what worked for me. Some people don't agree with methadone, but ultimately it saved my life. When I got on methadone, I was about to get both of my kids taken away. I had no job. I was sick looking. And from where I was when I started to where I am now is like night and day. I'm a completely different person.
And the idea that, as we were saying, as a recovery coach, you can look someone in the eye and say, I know exactly what you're going through. And what you say, those words matter, don't they?
Yes, a lot. When I had first started getting clean and stuff, I didn't have anybody like that. In doing the job that I do, I wish I had, because I think that it would have helped a lot. It maybe would have made things easier to be close to someone that had been in my shoes and been through the same exact stuff I had to, just to know that I can get through it, that other people have gotten through it, so I know that I can get through it.
Christy, do we need changes in the way that opioid drugs are labeled?
Yes, I think we need changes in the way that they're prescribed. Honestly, I think that too many doctors are too quick to prescribe them for everything. Obviously, if you've had surgery or something like that, I mean, it's okay, but I've been given pain pills for having a tooth pulled, something that Motrin would work for. Honestly, I think the way they label the bottles, I think there should be more of a warning on them, maybe right on them that, you know, you can get addicted to this and to be careful taking it. And I've always been told that when a doctor gives you a prescription for some kind of opiates, you're supposed to be weaned off of them so that you don't get addicted to them. Because when you're taking pills like that for, you know, any kind of amount of time, when you stop taking them, you're going to feel sick. So you're supposed to slowly be weaned off of them. And I honestly have never heard of any doctor doing that.
And really, it's on patients as well to not expect to walk out with a prescription in hand, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But there was actually one time when I went to the dentist and I had my wisdom teeth pulled and they had offered me Vicodin and I told them I didn't want them. And I had asked for ibuprofen and they told me, they flat out told me no, that the ibuprofen wouldn't work, that you needed that I needed the Vicodin. Mm. And they pushed it on me and pushed it on me after I told them I didn't want the prescription, and they gave me the prescription anyways. They insisted that I needed it, and there's no reason for that at all.
And what are the warning signs that we should watch for that might tell us that a friend or a coworker or a loved one could be getting addicted to opiates?
I think the big thing would definitely be changes in the mood, in their mood, mood swings. A lot of signs of somebody going through withdrawals is like sweating and watery eyes and yawning a lot and can't sit still. They can't sit still. They're really agitated, loss of appetite. Some people lose a lot of weight. But the main thing is the mood swings and not being able to sit still, really jittery and things like that.
So if someone's listening to what you're saying, Christy, and they're ticking off things going, yep, check. So mm-hmm. There's someone I love, I'm worried about. What then how do you bring that up to the person who's possibly using?
Honestly, I think it kind of depends on the person. Mm. I think it depends on their mental stability, whether they get upset about things easily or not. Usually in that situation, though, you have to approach it very carefully because it can really upset some people and make them take off and go do more. But you have to be really careful. Maybe sit down with them and, you know, ask them what's been going on, how have you been doing, and, you know, are you still taking the pain medication or whatever it is they're doing, and ask them if they think they have it under control or if they have a problem, and maybe slowly ease into it from there. You really have to be careful with it. The first time that my parents ever approached me with it, I flipped out on them. Because a lot of people initially don't want to admit that, and they don't want to think about it, that they've become addicted to it, because nobody wants that. And it almost makes you feel like a horrible person. So when somebody else approaches you and confronts you on it and asks you about it, you get upset because you don't want to admit it yourself. So when somebody else sees it, it makes it worse. But you have to be very careful how you approach it.
Christy Kopech is a recovery coach. She is 6 years in recovery from opiate addiction. She's with Victory Clinical Services in Saginaw and also a member of Peer 360, which is an organization of people in recovery. Christy, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us and insights. And I know that you continue to work to help people, and I know you've done that through this interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
After the break, one woman's story of recovery from opioid addiction that began with the very first pill. Then, instead of controlling technology, what happens when technology begins to control you? What does that mean for society as a whole? Author Alexander Weinstein explores this in his new book, Children of the New World. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Collaboration. Innovation.
The next idea.
The world doesn't stop. The world continues to change. So we as people need to change along with it.
Opining about the millennial generation has become almost a sport nowadays. But Jeff DeGraff, our partner on The Next Idea, looks at the shift in social values in America and sees lasting innovation. In his latest commentary, Jeff wonders whether this widening generation gap means we're approaching the death of marriage, capitalism, and God.
The next big thing isn't a clever gadget or a miracle drug. It's a way of life. Not a breakthrough invention, but a social innovation. Rising numbers of young people are now deciding to do everything their parents didn't. They're eschewing cultural and economic convention to challenge what we take to be civil society. They aren't marrying. They've become the refuseniks of our competitive corporate culture, and many of them have opted out of organized religion altogether. Let's start with a quick look at some facts. The end of marriage. According to the New York Times, over half of all American women under the age of 30 who gave birth are unmarried. When adjusted for levels of education and economics, the numbers skew dramatically higher. Of course, there's an array of possible causes to this trend, including everything from the relative economic independence of educated women to the shift away from the cultural stigma of unwed parentage to even a latent reaction to the divorce of their own parents. This change brings a complex array of challenges. For example, marriage is a foundational element of our legal system connected to property, beneficiary, and custodial rights and obligations. Scandinavian countries with the same downward trend for marriage among the young rank among the highest educated in the world with a standard of living position well atop our own. The end of capitalism. Well before the collapse of the middle-class economy in America, Europe, and now Asia, young people started cultural movements that shifted the center of balance from economics to social values. According to Pew Research, this change is creating an enormous generation gap between boomers and millennials that's still widening. It's likely a response to the worst employment prospects for young adults in almost a century, and a renewal of idealistic frontierism, with the new urban corridor as the 21st century Wild West. What were once areas of blight are now shining lights for our youth. Brooklyn, Cleveland, and Detroit come to mind. Signs of the new anti-commercialism are everywhere. Shared houses and cars, urban farm collectives, and the end of intellectual property rights. There's a noticeable shift away from traditional careers. Instead, many lean towards value-centric goals of communal harmony. The end of God. According to the Washington Post, 25% of millennials don't affiliate with a faith-based tradition, and almost twice as many don't belong to a church. More so, another Pew Research study suggests that an astonishing low number of young people believe in the existence of a God. As religious participation, affiliation, and even belief wane in post-Christian Europe and the Americas, atheism is now among the fastest-growing affiliation among young adults. It seems like some have turned an anti-faith into its own kind of faith. So why is this happening, and what does this mean? Many sociologists suggest that this transition is merely the 21st century version of the same irrational exuberance we saw in the late 1920s and the 1960s. They often frame these transitions as the adolescent stage of a grand cycle of divergence and convergence. This explanation implies that we should just let the cycle run its course and things will return to normal. In reality, though, boundless connectivity has changed the way we integrate our experiences with our interpretation of those experiences. It's created a whole new type of normal. The idea of a grand worldview that we all share has been replaced by a wide range of personalized worldviews. We have become a collective me. Is this the end of marriage, capitalism, and God? Yes and no. Our pieces are now our wholeness. Marriage, capitalism, and God will persist, but they'll reappear in new guises. Grand forces on a more personalized, intimate scale. The key concept here is hybrids, mixtures of old institutions and innovative new ways. The institutions that formerly served as bridges for diverse people with varied views are now impassable and separate us. Our young people are simply finding their own way to bring us back together.
Jeff DeGraff is a clinical professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan and our partner on The Next Idea. Views expressed in Jeff's essay are his own and do not necessarily reflect those of Michigan Radio, its management, or the station licensee, the University of Michigan.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Think of a group of people sitting around a table. Instead of talking together, heads are ducked down, people on their smartphones. Or the Pokemon Go players we saw all summer long, walking around, staring at their phones. We are intimately connected to technology, and many would argue too connected. Alexander Weinstein's new book, Children of the New World, makes this point in every single one of these short stories. We read of dangerously immersive virtual reality games, ordering up a robot to round out your family, reading emails on your eyes, living in memories you download. Weinstein teaches English at Siena Heights University. Children of the New World is his first collection of short stories. Alexander Weinstein, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, clearly, you've been working on these stories for, what, years now?
Yeah, 10 years.
Wow.
This is a 10-year collection.
And Pokemon Go hit big over this summer, but am I off base in that sense of discomfort? I cannot get over it, seeing so many people in the middle of this beautiful park who do not lift their eyes from the phone screen.
Yeah. Pokemon Go, I'm working somewhere in my subconscious right now with the Pokemon Go story because it's so absurd and such a great metaphor for this strange place we find ourselves in, right? I mean, you have people finding dead bodies through Pokemon Go. You've got grown men walking off cliffs and then everybody staring down at their phones.
And flocking together. Like that. Yeah. When it first started happening, what is happening here?
Yeah. And I see it as a metaphor. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about the spiritual metaphor of Pokemon Go, right? That we're all searching for these lost creatures who are ultimately ourselves, right? And seeking it through the phones and everybody looking down. It really sort of captures the technological craziness that we're in.
And certainly that you spell out in these stories that are collected in Children of the New World. And just to give everyone a sense of kind of what these stories are about, I'm going to give you the title of a story and you can kind of give us the kernel of what it is, like the elevator pitch, if you will.
Right.
The Cartographers.
So that's a corporation that manufactures memories. Quimbley, Barrett and Woods out of New York, they're making memories for people that want better parents, better childhoods. They just want a vacation that's cheaper to go on so they can have these memories implanted.
And you just download those memories and there they are.
Yeah.
Children of the New World.
That's a couple who has gone past the point of having children. And so they're able to have children through this new virtual technology where their avatars can get pregnant. And they didn't realize this when they signed on. And they end up with two virtual children that they love very much.
And then things ensue. We'll just say that. Migration. That was so touching.
Yeah. Similarly, another virtual world where everyone's living online and nobody goes outside anymore. Everybody just works online. They get their food shipped to them. And the crux of it is a teenage boy who wants to go bicycling.
And he goes outside.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to give you a baby boomer moment, everybody listening and you. These stories remind me of the kinds of challenging stories that I remember watching on those 60s-era TV shows, The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits. Rod Serling would do The Twilight Zone, the things that are grounded in our reality and kind of show us where we could go wrong. So maybe not so much satire, but a warning. Is that a fair way to look at these stories?
They're definitely warnings, right? And hopefully there's a lot of humor in it and compassion, too. But it definitely came out of my fear for where we're heading.
Yeah.
Right? We're all embracing technology with wide open arms and getting more and more trapped in our phones. I mean, I stop at a red light, I look over, and there are people checking their phones constantly.
Absolutely.
At bus stops, you have people launching birds at pigs, right? And I mean, these are grown people that are standing there playing these games.
Or go into a restaurant and watch a table of people.
Completely. Whole families sitting through the whole meal. Just checking their iPhones, you know, sending updates, doing new posts on their Facebook feeds. It's mildly depressing, right?
And you're a teacher, so you're seeing students.
Absolutely. That's where some of this came from. I mean, my students were saying – recently they've been saying they prefer texting to talking to people.
We say this to our 22-year-old daughter all the time. Why don't you phone them? Call them. But they're all texting away.
Yeah, people say they're afraid. I was actually asking the students about, you know, so how do you date? And would you call somebody for a date? And they said, "No, absolutely not. You'd never talk to them." And I said, "Why not?" And they said, "Well, it's too frightening." Right? And so there's this connection for the new millennial generation and the one that's coming after them where you see babies in cribs being given
An iPad or something
to play
with
to entertain them. So we're there. We're definitely in the sci-fi future already.
Would you read us an excerpt, if you will, from Children of the New World? And this
Love
is the beginning of the story that you title Openness. And I think it'll give everybody a good sense of the not too distant science sci-fi future that you envision.
Before I decided to finally give up on New York, I subbed classes at a junior high in Brooklyn. A sixth-grade math teacher, suffering from downloading anxiety, was out for the year. And jobs being what they were, I took any opportunity I could. Subbing math was hardly my dream job. I had a degree in visual art for which I'd be in debt for the rest of my life. All I had to show for it was my senior collection, a series of paintings of abandoned playgrounds stored in a U-Pack shed in Ohio. There was a time when I'd imagined I'd become famous, give guest lectures at colleges, have retrospectives at MoMA. Instead, I found myself standing in front of a class of apathetic tweens trying to teach them how to do long division without accessing their browsers. I handed out pen and paper so that for once in their lives they'd have a tactile experience, and watched as they texted, their eyes glazed from blinking off message after message. They spent most of the class killing vampires and orcs inside their heads and humoring me by lazily filling out my photocopies. The city overwhelmed me. Every day I'd walk by hundreds of strangers, compete for space in crowded coffee shops, and stand shoulder to shoulder on packed subway cars. I'd scan profiles, learning that the woman waiting for the N enjoyed thrash hop, and the barista at my local coffee shop loved salted caramel. I'd had a couple fleeting relationships, but mostly I'd spend weekends going to bars and sleeping with people who knew little more than my username. It all made me want to turn off my layers, go back to the old days, and stay disconnected. But you do that and you become another old guy, buried in an e-reader, complaining about how no one sends emails anymore. So I stayed open, shared the most superficial info of my outer layer with the world, and filtered through everyone I passed, hoping to find some connection. Here was City Cat 5, Jersey Girl 13, M3 Love. And then one morning there was Katie, sitting across from me on the N. She was Lake Girl 03, and her hair fell from under her knit cap. The only other info I could access was her hometown and that she was single. "Hi," I winked. And when I realized she had her tunes on, I sent off an invite. She raised her eyes. "Hi," she winked back. "Are you from Maine? I'm planning a trip there this summer. Any suggestions?" She leaned forward and warmth spread across my chest from being allowed into her second layer. "I'm Katie," she winked. "You should visit Bar Harbor. I grew up there." She gave me access to an image of a lake house with tall silvery pines rising high above the shingled roof. "Wish I could help more, but this is my stop." As she stood waiting for the doors to open, I winked a last message. "Can I invite you for a drink?" The train hissed, the doors opened, and she looked back at me and smiled before disappearing into the mass of early morning commuters. It was as the train sped toward work that her contact info appeared in my mind, along with a photo of her swimming in a lake at dusk.
That's Alexander Weinstein reading from his book of short stories, Children of the New World and Openness. So it's not hard to draw the line from where we are now to where this character is.
It's close.
It is close. Are you challenging, Alexander, people who are consumed by technology to stop, to put the brakes on, or what exactly?
Certainly to put the brakes on, just to take a pause for a moment, because we're hurtling towards this technological future and just saying, hold on a second, what are we losing? What are we trading off socially? What free time, for example? Do we want our free time back?
Technology was supposed to give us more free time.
Right. And instead we find ourselves updating online dating profiles, liking posts.
Checking Instagram to see who liked your latest
picture. Right. All these sort of sad outreaches for, you know, attention, right? Please love me, we seem to be saying. And then, of course, capturing Pokemon Go and God knows what else. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing that all the time. I mean, even myself, I find that I'm checking my phone 10 times a day, 20, 30.
Easily.
And so starting to realize, I think we all are seeing this. There's a kind of digital fatigue where people will take these Facebook breaks, right? They announce, I'm off for a week, right? And then they have this great, like, I'm back, you know, moment. And I think that's the start of us saying, you know what, I'd like to pull back a little bit. This is too much. What happened? And there's all sorts of course, natural effects of this, right? I mean, the open pit mines where all of the cell phone metals come from. And there's a big environmental cost, Apple suicide nets. You know, this is other stuff that we don't see, but that's equally important to start questioning. And of course, social media and technology and internet, all of this is great in many ways, right? For social protest, for getting information out.
Mm-hmm. Finding old friends, connecting.
Fantastic, yeah. Right? So somehow there's a balance needed. We're definitely out of balance, I would say, at this point, and that we're moving quicker and quicker. Now we have virtual reality coming. Google Glass sort of came and tried and went because we said no, but I think virtual reality, we seem to be excited and embracing.
It makes me wonder if we're going to see this generational divide where folks of a certain age that remember before we had no smartphones will feel one way. But, I mean, we kind of see this in your stories. And folks that, as you say, you see your students who don't want to even pick up hit call and talk to somebody.
Yeah, I think so. And then I think within the generations, you're also going to see a movement of people disconnecting. It's very hard to disconnect, though. I mean, it really is almost impossible at this point. And I think that may be what I'm trying to suggest, too. Is there ways that we can break out of technology just for a little bit and go back to some of the simpler ways of communicating and creating community?
Well, it's a fascinating collection, Children of the New World, sci-fi, but very relatable, very grounded in where we are today. A collection of short stories by Alexander Weinstein. Such a pleasure to meet you, have you here, and loved your stories.
Oh, pleasure too. Thanks so much.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Ryan Grimes. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.